Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to another episode of Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. With the end of another school year comes the inevitable graduation of our seniors. This semester, veteran reporter Ben Hallam joined the ranks of RCP alums and has moved on from the U of M. In Ben's absence, we will be listening back to some of his favorite pieces that he crafted while here at Real College Podcast. Coming up, we have words with the owner of Al's in Dinkytown, an in-depth look at homelessness in the Twin Cities, conversations with a reptile breeder, and how one U student tried to go from student government to local government. Be sure to stick around. During his time at RCP, Ben did an expose on Al's Diner in Dinkytown and spoke with them regarding their ties to the local music scene.
Sure, my name's Doug Grinna. I've owned Al's Breakfast for 40 years and worked here for 42. Before that, I spent 7 years in an experimental theater company. It would probably be called Performance Art now, called the Palace Theater and the Minnesota Ensemble Theater. And when I came over here, a bunch of actors that I knew came and worked for a while, and we've had actors and musicians and photographers and painters. We've had a lot of artists over the years. Steve Sorman worked here. I don't know if your viewers will know who he is. Listeners. Can't see anything on the radio.
That's Doug Grinna, one of the co-owners of Al's Breakfast in Dinkytown, near the University of Minnesota. Al's is perhaps most famous for its status as a neighborhood institution that's been around for nearly 70 years. As part of this reputation, it was even visited by Guy Fieri of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, who called it, quote, a
funky little place in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
But for this Real College Podcast piece on Al's Breakfast, I wanted to look at something different. I wanted to look at the way that Al's Breakfast has been home to a community of artists and creators, including owners Doug Grinna and Allison Kerwin.
I was a dance major at the University of Minnesota.
That's
Allison Kerwin, co-owner of Al's Breakfast.
You talked to me about how the consistent but flexible scheduling at Al's Breakfast is one of the primary things that allows people to engage in other projects outside of working at the restaurant, including work as artists.
A lot of people at Al's have other things that they do, and I was in school when I started here, and then I worked with a local dance company for a lot of years. And one of the things about Al's is that it's very flexible and it doesn't often kind of overlap with a lot of other jobs because it's early in the morning to afternoon, and a lot of the other jobs that I've had have been evening sort of situations, especially in restaurants and dancing and stuff. And so this was always kind of a good fit to supplement my income when I was both in school and later when I was dancing and doing other things. So it was an obvious choice to kind of supplement my income as I was moving through college and stuff.
And Allison believes Al's Breakfast has been an obvious choice for a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, I think we've always kind of been that for people. We've always been something that people can schedule around and that there's enough flexibility within the restaurant with other people wanting to work here and pick up shifts, and it's easy to kind of get things covered and do the things that we've always kind of strived to do. We've always had a lot of artists who've worked here, and that seems to be a good fit for a lot of people who have flexible jobs otherwise too.
According to longtime owner Doug Grinna, this flexibility is no accident. It was part of the reason he came to Al's in the first place, and it's been part of his philosophy ever since.
Yeah, I don't know. Al's has always been an art-friendly place, partially because our schedules are completely flexible, so artists can move around and do the things they need for their own work and still work at Al's. Well, it's always been my philosophy that whenever anybody that I'm working with or that's working for me, I want them to enjoy it so much they want to keep doing it. And they may regret that later. You want to make sure that everybody, your customers, the people you work with, everybody's got to be having a reason to be back.
Some of this dedication to flexibility comes from Grinna's own work as an artist, his background in experimental theater.
Yes, very much. I worked in an ensemble theater company, and we learned to be very much aware of what everybody was doing. And there was a system here always of you can learn the different jobs, but we really emphasize that now, and everybody knows every job. They come in the morning, they decide what they want to do between the dishes, the counter, and the cooking. And that's something I want. I want an ensemble where they all know what each other are doing and they can switch off whenever they can.
This sort of ensemble idea at ALS has played into the way that employees are able to switch off and on, not just between their jobs at the restaurant, but between their pursuits outside of ALS and the community they'd formed within it. Allison Kerwin described the way some of her work at Ragmala Dance Company and the community at ALS has come together over time.
And so working here was a good way to encourage new viewers for the dance company, for one thing. We've also gotten to use this space for fundraisers and things like that. We've done some dinners and things where the company comes in and cooks the food and serves people and stuff. So that's been an interesting way to get our customers involved in what the dance company does and vice versa. I don't know that I've done too much actual dancing behind the counter. It doesn't seem safe. So, you know, that we try to avoid. But ALS attracts a lot of very interesting customers, which a lot of times that kind of, it can be a good sounding board for artists to talk about what they're doing with other people who come in. It's also a good way to make contacts in other sorts of communities, other artist communities. And I think that we give people a lot of freedom here to kind of just be whoever they're going to be. And we don't really try to have just one fit for who our staff is. And I think that is really good for artists and other people who are trying to figure out what they really need to do in life.
As is the case with almost anything, once you get behind ALS Breakfast, the institution, ALS Breakfast, the famous restaurant that someone like Guy Fieri might see, once you really
take a look
at the people who run the restaurant and the people who work there, you'll see that far from being
dumpy
or a dive, it's actually a community of creative, hard-working people, both at the restaurant and outside. At the same time, it is still a restaurant. When I asked owner Doug Grinna if he had any important memories that stuck out to him from his career at ALS Breakfast, he told me this.
Has there been anything, like, interesting experiences that have stuck out to you, interesting people who have come through, any sort of, like, anecdote that you think would be something interesting to share?
You know, every day I come here, I look forward to it, and there have been a lot of interesting people. I mean, it shows more of how your brain works, what you manage to remember. One of the only things I can remember is a bizarre incident with a guy who threw up into a coffee cup. So my memory of what sticks out over the years may be only the outre.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
For our crime and safety episode, Ben did an investigative piece about homelessness in the cities. According to Ben, homelessness is a much bigger danger to the unhoused than for the community as a whole.
It doesn't seem right that someone can be thrown in jail for the crime of not having a home. But that's exactly what happened to Randy, a formerly homeless man who shared his story with me for the podcast.
And I was catching the bus, actually, and I went into the terminal. It was on 7th Street. So I sit there probably 10 minutes, and then the security guard was like, well, you have to leave. You have to get out of here. You're homeless, and you just can't sit here. I said, I'm not going nowhere. I have bus fare. He called the cops. The cops came, and when I hand them the community ID, they was like, oh, you're homeless. Well, did he tell you to leave? And then they said, well, you're under arrest. So they arrested me for trespass. What wound up happening was when I went to court, they were expecting for me to plead guilty, and I said, no, I'm taking this to trial. So just so happened that my lawyer got the video, and the video showed me just sitting there, and I was found not guilty. And that was sticking in my mind forever. The reason why the police took me to jail, because I was homeless.
This sort of experience, being thrown in jail solely for being or even looking homeless, is a common one for the unhoused residents of Minneapolis and St. Paul. According to U of M geography PhD candidate Eric Goldfisher, that's because homeless people have become a visual signifier for urban decay, poverty, and crime. They are seen as a blight to be contained, rather than a logical consequence of our capitalist housing system. I spoke to Eric over the phone from New York, where he works on homelessness advocacy.
I think that's kind of a central dynamic around the visuality of homelessness, is that homeless folks are used as a visual red herring. That has a lot to do with race, right? It has a lot to do with gender and ability and deviance, and is a way to demarcate who does and who does not belong in public space. You know, the sight of a homeless person indicates a neighborhood is unsafe, or a street is unsafe, or a park is unsafe. The way that homeless people are seen visually has a huge impact on the larger policies that form around homelessness, right? So in other words, most public policy that gets formed around homelessness is formed off of particularly visual ideas of homelessness, not necessarily on the fact of not having a home. You would think that policy would have to do with trying to provide people with homes, but instead, if you look at policies around homelessness, they usually have much more to do with policing, and they have to do with keeping people in certain spaces and away from other spaces. And so that's kind of was my starting point in thinking about...
To find out what impact this policing-first approach to homelessness has on homeless communities, I spoke to Erica and Chris, two outreach workers with St. Stephen's, a major homelessness services provider in the Twin Cities. According to them, this focus on policing leads to a pattern of shifting camps that, while providing the appearance of safety for housed people, puts the unhoused at risk.
So there's essentially this pattern of people trying to set up a camp somewhere or just sleep somewhere and not necessarily even have a camp set up and just being moved along and told, well, you can't sleep here. So then they don't have a place to go still, so they'll move down the block. And then somebody else tells them, well, you can't sleep here. So people are kind of just being moved around. People's belongings end up just being taken and thrown away if their camp is cleared out or if they're told that they can't stay in a spot. So people are frequently losing possessions, and sometimes those are things that are really important to them. Sometimes they're personally important, but they also could be important for survival even.
A lot of it is perception of being unsafe by community members, the people that are calling and asking for these cleanouts.
Randy, the formerly homeless man, shared his story of a camp cleanout and how it brought an end to a community that provided a small slice of security.
And that's, you know, if you're, the way they deal with homeless people, and I'm not saying all the police officers, is they just put you in jail to get rid of you. You're looked up on as like a disease, you know, where they're sitting there and they're saying to themselves, well, we're going to clean this up and we're going to have an image and we're just going to push these worthless people out of the way. Hillside, that's the place we had that was safe, that were homeless. We were all homeless. We looked out for each other and stuff, and we slept there. And the police would come over and tell us to leave. You're constantly told to move and you have nowhere to go. You're constantly on the move. You have no time to think about nothing else but how am I going to survive? You say it's the cycle. They call it the trail. That's what it's called when you're homeless. I'm going to hit the trail. You know, everybody knows what that means.
These policies which treat homeless people as a risk ignore one simple fact. Homeless people are more at risk than anyone. Here's Chris and Erica speaking about some of the risks homeless people face.
In terms of safety, the people that are living on the streets are much more likely to be the victims of violence and to be robbed and have their things stolen due to the fact that they don't have a safe place to be at night. So when we are talking about safety, and I think it's important to remember that the people that are staying on the streets, due to the fact that we don't provide housing for everybody, are exposed to very real violence. Speaking generally, every day we see people that have been assaulted the night before or have been robbed or have had that kind of thing happen.
There's also a large extent to which people who end up homeless may be homeless because of experiencing some kind of abuse or trauma. So to illustrate that, about 1/3 of women experiencing homelessness are homeless because of some kind of domestic abuse or violence.
When the real safety concerns are taken into account, the safety concerns of homeless people, maybe it doesn't make sense to keep homeless people out of the way, to push them to the margins, or to imprison them. Maybe one way to deal with homeless people is to create a public space that is welcoming for everyone, and to provide public housing for the unhoused members of our community. Here's Eric.
But I think there's something to be said for the idea of just letting people be, as long as they're not actively hurting themselves or hurting someone else, right? That would also get to the idea of seeing homelessness differently, right? There's a certain point in which you have to directly attack that image of homeless people as causing harm or homeless people as dangerous, and changing the image of homelessness to not be a person, but to instead be like a building that's being, you know, held vacant by a landlord so that he can get more money off it when gentrification hits a neighborhood, right? Or, you know, changing the image of homelessness to be a shelter which looks like a prison, basically, rather than a person on the street.
As homelessness and the safety concerns it produces becomes an increasingly common topic in political discourse, it's important to remember the communities who are most at risk. the unhoused people themselves. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
During our past Valentine's Day special, Ben sat down with a reptile breeder and discovered what it takes to truly love those with cold blood.
This particular story is one that I've wanted to do for a little bit of time while I've worked here on the podcast. You see, freshman year, one of my friends in the dorm invited me to join a Facebook group called Minneapolis Reptiles. I don't know how he got in the group or why he was in the group, but it was just something that was so interesting to me, to both of us, that it existed, that there was this community in Minneapolis and kind of around the world dedicated to the care and raising of reptiles, which were an animal that to me was something so foreign and so strange. But what wasn't foreign was the love that these people had for their animals. Like, I've had pets all my life. I know what it's like to have feelings of love and care towards an animal, and that was exactly the same. So in keeping with this week's episode theme of Love is in the Air, I talked with Karsten Mikeworth, a reptile breeder and operator of Minneapolis Reptiles and ISO Psychos, to find out what it takes and what it means to love reptiles. And it turns out, cockroaches. Walking into the rooms where Karsten kept his reptiles and insects was like walking into a zoo. It was amazing. There were so many animals in tanks and tubs lining the walls of two whole rooms of his house. It was hard to believe that he had used to have a larger breeding operation. As we talked, Karsten took the time to show me some of his animals, including some of his favorite reptiles, his leopard geckos.
Wow. So that's a leopard gecko that just hatched today?
It is. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I really like leopard geckos. I mean, they're kind of a basic reptile. A lot of people have had them, but I work with a lot of high-end color mutations, and I just love their attitude. I tongue feed them stuff all the time, and they're very catty. They'll wag their little tail and look at you with their little cocked head, and it's just so adorable. And the carpet pythons I really like too. They can be kind of rude sometimes. Some people don't like them. They're an acquired pet, but I always say just be the tree, and they're usually pretty calm.
Do you remember like the first reptile you ever had, or the first pet of that kind?
When I was a kid, my mom had a green anole, and his name was Mike. I was about 3 or 2, and then we also had a huge Pac-Man frog named Buddy. But once he got big enough to have to eat mice, my mom didn't really like having that pet anymore. And I would always let Mike the anole out because I was so curious. I'd wait till she was sleeping and go wrangle him out. He'd get out for a few days and we'd find him laying in the sun.
And what's making that noise that we kind of keep hearing in here? Is that...
The chirping is actually dart frogs.
Dart frogs.
Yeah, we got dart frogs calling.
So they're just hanging out in here?
Yep.
After looking at the dart frogs, I asked Karsten how he moved from a love of reptiles to a business of reptile breeding.
When I was growing up, my mom only let me have like 3 or 4 pets at a time, so I always had to kind of sneak them in sometimes and try and hide them. And right when I turned 18, I moved in with a ex-girlfriend and decided, hey, I'm going to buy a bunch of reptiles. And then it got expensive to feed, and of course I just wanted to fuel my habit essentially, and just keep the ball rolling, get new stuff, and keep everybody fed and happy.
And what have been some of your favorite things to work with over the years?
Definitely the roaches, weird enough. I mean, I got my first roaches to breed as feeders, and then I started seeing how cool some of the species were, and one species turned into 5, and 5 turned into almost 30 now. And then same thing happened with the isopods. I bought my first ones to sell as, or to breed as feeders for my dart frogs, and now I have 58 different color morphs and species.
Yeah, check out the other room. And these are cockroaches?
Yep, these are rhino roaches. They're native to Africa, and this is actually the world's heaviest species of roach. And then I also have giant cave roaches, which are the world's longest species of roach. I can make a hiss or hiss for you, probably.
Okay, we could see about that. Just trying to get ambient audio, too. These are, so there's just a lot, all these bins up here, are those all cockroach bins, yeah. Different types of cockroaches?
Yeah, I can show you some of the isopods, too, in the other room.
Show you these guys. Yeah, I guess keep thinking about that.
These are the world's longest species.
These are the world's longest species of roach? Oh my god. Those are really long. What would you say that you like especially about the roaches in particular, like breeding them? You talked a little bit about like different shapes and kind of things like that, but
yeah, I definitely think they're misunderstood. Like there's certain roaches that I wouldn't dare keep in my house in fear of an infestation, but most of these species I keep are tropical and they just come in so many different colors and they actually have little personalities, and if you hold fruit in there they'll come up and eat it out of your hand and move their little antennas to talk. Like they're just an amazing creature.
And people use those to feed to their animals like snakes or things like that? No, maybe not snake.
Yeah, it's more of like a collection. It's like live Pokemon cards. Like, I don't know, certain people are into them, certain people aren't, but I have maybe like 5 species that are primarily for feeders, but the majority of my collection at this point is just pure hobby and enjoyment.
Next, we checked out some of Karsten's isopods.
Yeah, I really like the isopods because they come in so many different colors. It's amazing, and there's always people finding new color mutations. That's one of my biggest dreams, to find an original one of something so I can start my own line. And it's so fun. You just get to collect and trade and sell. And like I said, it's just like Pokemon cards, but for a big kid.
I'd like to thank Karsten Mikeworth for showing me all of his reptiles and insects and providing me a window into this world, into which I've really only ever seen through Facebook. I started out wanting to do a story about reptile breeding because it was something strange and something I didn't understand, but as I was talking to Karsten, I realized that it's not that difficult to understand at all. It's the same kind of love and passion that anyone feels for anything that really interests them and speaks to them on some level. And with that, I'll leave you with Karsten Mikeworth.
A lot of them are just downright beautiful, and it's every single one's unique. I mean, they all have their own little personality. Even if you can't necessarily classify that all leopard geckos are going to be nice, just like you can't say all dogs are going to be nice. They're not the same. They all have their little personalities and they all look different and they're just so unique.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
While at RCP, Ben did a story covering a student from the U who declared their candidacy for the Minnesota House of Representatives.
Well, my name's Austin Berger. I am 21 years old. I was 20 when I launched this campaign. And I'm running for the Minnesota House of Representatives, that's the state house, in District 45A. That includes 4 precincts in the city of Crystal, 3 precincts in the city of Plymouth, and 7 precincts in the town I've been a lifelong resident of, New Hope.
This past December, I read a story in the Minnesota Daily about a University of Minnesota student and former member of student government, Austin Berger, who had announced a campaign for the Minnesota House seat 45A to replace Lyndon Carlson, a longtime DFL incumbent who recently announced his retirement. I was immediately interested, and I thought it would be a great story. I wanted to find out how a career in student government prepares you to become a politician, and whether someone my own age could really be prepared to take on the role of a legislator. Austin certainly made a convincing argument, drawing on his experience interning with Minnesota state senators and working on legislative teams in the Capitol.
I think when we talk about experience in young people, we like to point out that young people don't have, say, a 20-year CV under their belt or any other manner of qualification that tends to be more typical or par for the course for today's politics.
And that's the thing. We do have experience as young folks running for office. It's just not the kind of experience that has been conventional. I don't need a law degree to tell you how a bill is crafted and how to build consensus on it, because I went there on the front lines in the Capitol to learn how to do that. I think I'm qualified to be a Minnesota House representative because I've seen the work they do. I have an intimate appreciation for the nuances of policymaking at the Capitol in St. Paul. And I know I can do the job and that I can do it right.
Austin also went past his resume at the Minnesota State Legislature, arguing that his experience in youth activism was another qualification for office that many older candidates wouldn't have.
Back in March 2018, I helped organize the March for Our Lives at the Minnesota State Capitol, and that was the first time I ever gave a speech in public, was in front of 20,000 people on the steps of the Capitol. I had never felt more comfortable behind that podium than I had anywhere in my life. And it's because I realized that the words I was speaking into that microphone, they were giving people hope. And ever since then, I've just always been trying to fight for that which inspires hope among people. Things like shutting down
downtown Minneapolis. But one key part of Austin's resume, and part of what intrigued me about his candidacy, was his experience in student government. I wondered, how did Austin's experience in student government prepare him for state government? And how might his record in student government reflect on his qualifications for office? I was especially interested to find out more about his resignation from his position as MSA representative to the Student Senate Consultative Committee in mid-October of last year. What I found out was, to put it simply, complicated. Austin's former colleagues had a decidedly mixed view of his time in office, one that reflected an admiration of his political acumen, combined with a sense of concern about how far he might go. Take Cassidy Drummond, who worked under Austin in the Student Senate.
I do think he, okay, I've always felt conflicted because it's like he does problematic things, but I do think he has good intentions when he does them. But then also I think some of the motivation behind it is like, I mean, I always think it is kind of somewhat in for political gain, but I do think he has good intentions when he did the things that he did. I do think he would be a great politician because I think in politics, like, it is about people pleasing. It is about making people feel heard. And I don't think like a lot of politicians are necessarily genuine most of the time. I've always seen him in this position as a politician. And as far as like getting things done in student government, like he was always like very, anything he was passionate about, like he was going to get done. And like he was going to do the research and reach out to the people he needed. And I do think he was like a great senator. Again, it's like not
those
one to really have
things that he did
kind of
that
like,
Cassidy
oh,
mentioned
right.
were one of the hardest like, parts of this story to pin down. I asked Austin about the events surrounding his resignation from the Minnesota Student Association in October of last year, but he cited the toxic culture in MSA and claimed that he simply wanted to use his time more usefully and could not do so in the organization. However, several former MSA members who I spoke to on background, but who wished to remain anonymous, characterized Austin as a part of this toxic culture. I spoke with one member of MSA, Jude Goosens, the current head of legislative and government affairs for the Minnesota Student Association, about his experience with
Austin. Being very explicit, I'm not commenting on his campaign. In my experience, objectively, he was the source of targeted attacks, spreading misinformation, and abusing his position of power in an extremely inappropriate way. So it was, early September. Pending my confirmation in forum, Austin sent out an email to all of the senators that were in forum. And in that email, he claimed that I was going to be giving a voice of approval to one of our city councilors about that project, the Dinkytown development, the one that was going to take up the McDonald's, like that half block with McDonald's and Dinkytown Wine and Spirits and that whole area. And kind of painting that in a very negative sense. And the way that he framed it was basically, there's going to be a vote happening. I hope that you all take this information and act on that. Again, wanting to note explicitly that information that he gave to all of them was false. So we weren't for or against the property anyway, because it's more complicated than that, to be frank. Like, I'm not saying this as like in the sense that woe is me. Just wanted to be very objective about the facts of, my experience with him was not positive. There was dishonesty. There was, personal vendetta. There was trying to use his power to influence people against me based on misinformation that he was telling them, and I just find that to be highly inappropriate. He did inevitably resign.
But despite some concerns that remained, Austin Berger's campaign seemed to have left these MSA squabbles behind when I attended a campaign fundraiser at Mancini's. There, the focus was on youth and on the future. Joe Selton, a longtime member of the 45th House District and retirement coordinator for the Machinist Union, expressed the sentiment many people at the fundraiser felt toward Berger's campaign and their optimism for his future.
I'm glad to see some younger people stepping up
to take on some of the reins that we need to have taken on. They come with a better perspective of what's going on. Austin seems to be a guy that will fill the bill for us. He's got fire in his belly. I think he'll do a good job for us. So that's why I came down here to donate some time and some money.
I think that if reporting on Austin Berger's campaign taught me one thing about what it means to run for office as a college student, it's this. For a young candidate with such a short record, what's most important are the things they did most recently. For candidates like Austin Berger, that includes both youthful political fire and passion. But it also includes the petty conflict that characterizes so much of life in college and earlier. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
Thank you for your time, dedication, and passion, Ben. Hopefully, we will see you back in Minneapolis real soon. Signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.